ghostly, mother. No ghostly.
And do me a favor. Don't disturb my friend. He's dead tired.
Well, what the hell are you saying, Doss? You bruised half your body sleeping.
I sleep pretty hard.
Welcome to Rock and Roll Bedtime Stories.
Hey, it's Brian.
And hey, it's Murdoch. Welcome to Rock and Roll Bedtime Stories.
Occasionally, we find ourselves on this show making unofficial follow-ups or like in an unofficial series of podcast episodes. We don't even mean to. Earlier this year, we did this. We were talking about crowd crush tragedies. Not a super fun subject, but there's a lot of them, and we learned a lot, kind of, and those built on each other. More recently, we've been consistently taking inquiries from you in the audience. We are thestoryguys@gmail.com if you want to get involved, about artists who seem to have just like disappeared from the public.
Disappear. And way back, episode 147, we talked about Bobby Gentry.
She's like the ultimate example of this, right? The right. OG, walking away from it all. And in some ways, that is this episode. A little bit, right? Like, yeah, it's a little closer to that. But more recently, we talked about Darcy Redsky from the Smashing Pumpkins, and we've talked about Greg Alexander very recently from the New Radicals, and he had a different thing, right? He decided not to leave music, but to leave being in front and on stage, and he wanted to go back behind the scenes, and he did that. So that brings us to today, and a letter that I found in the stacks that I thought would be... nice, because it would continue this conversation a little bit, okay? It is a simple inquiry from New England again. Thank you to our stronghold in New England. I think you and I need to do a tour up the New England coast. What do you think?
It's like a part of the country I haven't spent enough time in sober.
It's great. Let me just tell you. You said sober. Maine is amazing. You know I love Maine. Niagara Falls is like literally behind the birth of my children and my wedding day, the happiest day of my life, the day I went to Niagara Falls. We should do that.
Yeah.
We should do that together. Just me and you in a Volkswagen, like maybe like in a Volkswagen van. I actually own a Volkswagen, but it's not that cool. But we could get an old Volkswagen. Tour
it
the
is
Northeast.
Not hippie cool at all. A friend of mine just came back from Maine and was like, dude, you got to freaking
It's amazing.
Go to Maine.
Maine's amazing. Yeah, anyway, New England. Fernando, this is what he writes.
Yeah.
Read it.
What happened to Meg White? By the way, Rolling Stone's 94th best drummer of all time.
they put her at 94?
Yeah, I know, man.
Do you remember the first time you saw the White Stripes? Not heard them, saw them.
Yes. I only saw them once, and it was because a former coworker that you'll know named Chrissy just turned to me and said, hey, do you want to go see this band called the White Stripes? Like, And so I didn't know, and this was with someone who I'm not married to now, and I didn't really even look at the seats or anything, and it was at the Taft
In Cincinnati.
Theater?
Yeah.
In Cincinnati. So... I look and I'm like, oh, it's row A.
Oh, you were front row in an early, what era is this? Like what period?
No, I'm not front row, dude. Hang on. So I'm not only front row, I'm in front of the front row in a folding chair.
One of those. Yeah.
And so this is around, I think, the time that you saw them too. And we were so close, and I want to wax about this just a minute.
Okay.
We were so close that I thought, man, Jack White has done, like, has this Robert Plant pants thing going on. Like, there is a monster in my pants, and it does a nasty dance. When it comes into a room, people hit it with a broom. So that's Fred Schneider, B-52s. But I was close enough to watch the interaction, the sensual interaction, which is probably that was probably programmed into the act that we talk about later but it was monstrous and it was loud and it was and I never left my seat. I never got a drink.
Yeah.
I don't remember who opened or but anyway, but go ahead. That's the first time.
So
and
that,
only time I
that
saw
tour, I think the Greenhorns are opening. So if it's the same tour, so it might have been the Greenhorns. Anyway, I bring this up because this duo is a fantastic subject for this show because they were so heavy on lore. And when I say see them, I also mean like, do you remember was this the first time you ever had seen the visual? Was when you saw them in concert or did you see them before that?
I had seen them before that, for sure, because I had, so I lived here. So I'm just trying to piece it together. Oh, it has to be after 2001 because I moved here in 2004.
Oh, okay.
Think about that.
Yeah.
So I was very well aware of them and like had seen them like on the Grammys or stuff like that. So yeah.
So it was It was a little farther in when you saw them.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Space and time and everything is weird. But the thing was, like, there was a lot of other stuff. And the history of Detroit and the music in that city is unbelievably rich. But at the time, they were really carrying the weight of, like,
That's such a good point, because they were the subject of, like, a million magazine profiles between that period of time, like 2000 to 2005, about garage rock and the revival and the Detroit sound and the new MC5 and whatever, right? Are there other bands from that scene that you still dig? Von Bondies, Detroit Cobras, any of those guys?
For the Von Bondies, I just remember that guy's black eye, which, by the way, was brutal. You ever see that picture?
I remember he just kept getting in trouble, but that's all I really remember.
Him and Jack got into a fight, and there was a picture of the black eye that Jack gave him, and it's more than a black eye. Like, it looked like he hit him with, like, a brick. Like, he just knocked the shit out of it. So when I think about the Von Bondies, I just think about that guy.
So
the Detroit Cobras, dude, holy shit, I still listen to the Detroit Cobras now. There's a band that broke up called the Paybacks. And the singer was a female, but she sounded like Rod Stewart. She was a writer for the Detroit Free Press. The Paybacks, they're unreal. They have two records that came out. And the Gories, too. Those were three bands I think I listened to out of Detroit.
Okay, so as for the White Stripes, you mentioned me seeing them. They were the elusive band that I never actually saw, but I almost did. My first encounter, we'll talk about that. My first encounter with them, though, just in general, figuring out who they were, was June 7th, 2001. And I know you asked me, why the hell do you have a date for that? I looked it up. I had just graduated high school, by that calculation, probably literally within days before. I was enjoying the freedom of that first last summer, you know how that is, right? When you graduate high school before you go to college and really understand that life kind of sucks. I was enjoying all of these things, and I am pretty sure that ironically, I think I was a black and white TV in my room in which I might have seen them. You can still tell that they're two-tone, right? Even if you don't know that it's red and white. And it was the Craig Kilborn show. This is famously their first live television appearance. They choose Craig Kilborn, which is sort of weird, and they play a song called Screwdriver. The clip is in the show notes.
Right, and the song selection is really noteworthy here, right? Because those of you listening, you're like, oh, that's part of their greatest hits. Nope.
No?
It's not. It's one of their earliest songs, and it's even old at that point in 2001 when they're on Kilborn. So this is Jack talking about choosing that song. It's a quote directly from him. Quote, "We wanted to show what the band was about. We weren't behind a single or anything at that point. We were in a cool position. If you're some major label band or you go on to Craig Kilborn, they'll say, you got to do this song. It's the one we pushed on college radio. But we were in a position where we could do anything we wanted to do."
And I just remember being like, what is happening as I watched these two animals hit instruments? Famously, as I'm sure I've said on this show before, 2.5 months later, I will move 3 hours away to state school, where every street, literally the week I move in, every street post within 4 blocks of my dorm is adorned with a black and white poster declaring that the White Stripes are going to play at JR's Lightbulb Club in a basement under a pizzeria. I saw a lot of epic shows there. I saw Lucero there a ton. And I immediately plan to have a big night out on this night that is just about a month away when I move in. Turns out, though, that night was September 11th, 2001. I was not in the mood. Figured they'd canceled the show. Find out later that they did not.
Yeah, yeah. Pearl Harbor for us.
Yeah, I mean, really, in a lot of ways, right? And so I am the perfect age when they explode. Their rise corresponds with my time in college. So even if I didn't like them or don't like them, they're so much in the fabric of that time of my life. My other main collegiate memory, this is embarrassing and kind of funny, of the White Stripes music would happen a few years later. And again, can narrow it down. I know it was like the last week of October of 2003. I got real drunk at a party, and the cover band there was playing Seven Nation Army, and apparently I got real flirty with someone who was not the person I was dating. The only time that my college girlfriend and I almost broke up, luckily we patched it up and are about to celebrate our 20th wedding anniversary next year. So
I never knew this story, you dog.
It's not good, dude. It's not good. The most convincing I've ever had to be was the next day, and since then I've learned my lesson.
Yeah, and I definitely never did this in this situation with the lovely person who I'm celebrating my anniversary with this week. It'll be 15 years this week.
Oh, wow. Congratulations,
yeah,
man.
Right. But when I was younger and in a band, and I wasn't with this person who never, ever came to my shows, let's just say there was a lot of people flirting with me.
Yeah.
And maybe it was because of the... I think one time she came to see me play, like, finally, and she goes, "You make your O face."
Oh, like, you do. Yeah. I remember that. Yeah. I mean, I don't know what's your O face, but I assume that's similar to what your O face looks like. I have seen you play bass before.
So when you saw me play in Boomerangatang, were you like, that guy playing the bass is making an O face?
Yeah. Yeah. 100%.
Was that like, would you consider that just absolutely embarrassing and humiliating now that was me making my own?
Dude, I hang out with you as much as possible, so you could take from that whatever you want, but you're like one of my favorite people in the whole world, so I think your O-face is...
Yeah, I love it. My O-face.
It clearly won the friendship, that's what I'm saying.
I'm telling you, I do. I love you too, Brian.
Okay, let's talk about, instead of me and you, let's talk about other two people. Let's talk about Meg and Jack.
Just two people.
At the center of this, two people, not three, not four, not five. They are dressed in two colors. They sound pretty dissonant, and they may or may not be brother and sister or husband and wife or kindergarten teachers. Who knows? Whatever the hell else they might be.
Or they look like two pieces of candy. They used to be married, and if you didn't know, Jack took Meg's last name. True story.
I honestly thought the names were fake for both of them, but no, her birth name is actually White. He is born John Anthony Gillis in 1975, one of 10 kids, as you might guess it, Catholic.
Oh, how stereotypical. Sorry. I don't know what I'm supposed to say there. Growing up with no religion, which is a fun fact because it leads us to a more fun fact, is that he was an altar boy at Holy Redeemer Parish during a period where a film crew was shoot. This is a crazy story. I'm so glad you guys are all on board with us here. There was a film crew shooting an Elmore Leonard script with Donald Sutherland there called The Rosary Murders, and 12-year-old John, or Jack White, as you would know, is in some shots. The clips are on YouTube. You're welcome.
And in the show notes. He said in interviews at one point that he actually thought he would be a priest because he was so Catholic. He was accepted into seminary at one point, everything. I'll be honest, while reflecting and researching on this episode, I reflected on that idea that I am the perfect age for the White Stripes because I actually wasn't a huge fan. Now I think nostalgically I'm more of a fan. I have a friend who's a really big Jack White fan, and so I've, you know, learned to love that a little bit more. But traditionally, minimal garage rock is not my thing unless it's like the original iteration, like MC5 level. But my opinion on Jack White started to change when he did a Marc Maron WTF interview several years back. Did you ever hear that?
Yeah, it's where everyone found out that he did upholstery. Like, that's what he did.
Yes, he talks at length about how he used to and still does reupholster things. Yeah. I got so fascinated by this aspect of him. He apprentices, he's good at it, and supposedly the only reason he didn't keep doing it is he was very bad at the business side of it. There's a lot of little tidbits you'll read about how he used to like write poetry inside the furniture and then like zip it back up, which is funny to me for some reason.
Which, when I heard that, it made me think, like, I wonder how hard this would be for me to learn how to do this, because it seems like it's a plumber job, it's an electrician job, like it's a gig that won't go away.
Yeah,
like you can't AI your way out of it. Anyway, so when Jack John, when he apprentices, he is working under this guy named Brian Muldoon, who's a family friend. And when they are in the shop together, this guy is playing in punk rock and convinces him to start a band called, you guessed it, The Upholsterers. By the way, He was in another band.
Yeah.
Jack
yeah.
was in another band. And do you know what they were called?
There were several very early, like when he was in high school and early college.
Age. I remember getting this a record by them in college, but like I didn't know anything about him. And they were called Goober and the Peas.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's and he right.
He was a drummer. Yeah.
So we can assume. And Jack is drumming in these bands. That is worth pointing out. We can assume one of the bands he hears during this period when he is upholstering furniture with Brian Muldoon is this group called the Flat Duo Jets. This is a group he will cite as an influence and name drop a lot in subsequent years. It intros him into the guitar drums idea. And in this band with Brian, he does, in fact, play drums. I do have some audio of that. It is in the show notes. Spoiler alert, kind of sounds like the White Stripes.
And dude, I love the Flat Duo Jets. It's like very kind of 90s indie rock. Like it's dead kind of spot on of that. He does that apprenticeship from 15 to 18. And then he starts playing in other bands too. It's around 18 when he meets this girl who works at a restaurant in Royal Oak, Michigan.
Now, I've read different versions of how Meg and Jack will meet. Some say coffee shop, some say restaurant. This place makes sense. It's a place called Memphis Smoke. It closed back in 2010, but for quite a while before that, it was known not just for food, but live blues music. That's a place you would want these two to meet, right? And the timeline is 93, 94, probably, when they meet.
Yeah, and the timeline on them is interesting. When they get together, she doesn't play drums. That's like, this is not part of their Marvel origin story here. That comes later when they get famous and they're already divorced.
Yeah, so the marriage is from like 96 to 2000. Over before I see them on Kilborn, the summer after high school.
Yeah, and it breaks in the press right before that performance. I don't know if people remember that this was a thing that people cared
people
about
very much cared about it. I still think people care about it a little bit.
Yeah but they full-on commit to this act that they're brother and sister. Like he'll say, here's my sister Meg. Like there's the kind of back and forth that happens on stage, and where he talks about her and refers to her as his sister, to this extent that there is a legit investigative report that blows open this bullshit story that they've been doing for a while.
Chris Walton is the name of the guy at the Detroit Free Press who will dig up divorce papers at the end of March 2001, and he'll go public with it. The question becomes why? Why did they position themselves this way?
Yeah, and it's very simple when you hear about this from Jack, how he explains it. This is a quote direct from him. When you see a band that is two pieces, husband and wife, boyfriend and girlfriend, you think, oh, I see. But when they're brother and sister, you go, oh, that's interesting. You care more about the music, not the relationship, whether they're trying to save their relationship by being in a band.
And this brings me back to the point about them being perfect subjects for this show, because they were creating their own rumor and innuendo from the very beginning of their own marketing ploy when they were starting this thing.
Yeah. It's like the Ramones. Let's all dress alike and make our last name the same.
Yeah.
Right? To your point about calculation, there's a quote in Meet Me in the Bathroom, terrific book, about the reemergence of garage rock aesthetic in New York in the early 2000s, where it's described that Jack White gets irritated when the White Stripes get booked with the Yeah Yeah Yeahs.
Oh, this is fun. Really, yeah, this is so
it's
fun.
Really interesting. This is a quote from Jack. Our band's problem in the early years was that local promoters would say, oh, wouldn't it be cute to put our local two-piece band on there to open for them? Or the White Stripes must hate the bass. Let's book a band that has no bass to warm up for them. So, yeah, when we rolled into blah, 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 Ohio, there would be a no-bass band with a girl on drums booked to play with us, and we'd say, of course. We always wished for a band that was the exact opposite of us, so we could have a contrast.
So I was talking about this concept the other day. I was going to see someone and I was listening to the band that was opening for them, and my comment was, this band sounds too much like the band I'm going to see, right? Like I need the you know, what's on the plate to be a little bit different, right? How do you feel about that?
Oh, I like now, like I really want to have a contrast. I think it's really important versus the same thing, unless they're like my two favorite bands or bands that I really like.
Right. Well, continuing this idea of a band having an image to keep, did you know that before the band, but after his apprenticeship with Brian Muldoon, that he does own his own upholstery business,
yes.
That he does, he like completely does the whole look for. And he decides that he's going to make everything two colors.
Right.
And including his van, his logo, the whole thing, black and yellow. And it's supposedly during this time that he's like, you know, I could do this with a band, too, and just make everything red and white.
Yeah, the calculation is great here and how the image with the band is just perfect. The About a Girl podcast, which is a scripted narrative anthology series about women whose stories have long been eclipsed by the legends of their famous partners, did a great Meg White story. That episode was in 2021.
Yeah, if you've never heard this show, excellent companion piece for this episode. So I would say go ahead and download it now and listen to it next. And then check it out because they do an episode on Sharon Osbourne. Lots of stuff that we've covered, but they do it in a way that is a little different and a lot of fun. Anyway, on this pod, they paint this picture of the beginning of this band being Jack playing David Bowie on guitar in the attic and Meg messing around while sitting at his drum set. Now, a little biographical detail that I learned in the research is that at some point around this time, like I said, Jack is the last of 10 kids. So his parents are quite a bit older. I'm not sure that they have died, but they have maybe downsized and they have given Jack the house. And so when Jack and Meg first get married, they live in his childhood house and they hang out a lot in the attic. So this sort of sets the scene for this, right? And to this ongoing point about them creating their own lore, you will see it written in multiple pieces. I kept running across this, that Meg White learns to play the drums. And they say this like it all happened in one day. Learns to play the drums on Bastille Day of 1997. Yes. What? What does that mean? Read how Rolling Stone will describe their live performance even in 2005. So this is 8 years after they form. This is how Rolling Stone talks about them playing. This harkens back to what you described when you saw them at the Taft Theater in Cincinnati.
For sure. Jack and White are playing to each other. He stands at a mic set at the foot of her kit, his eyes pinned on her as he sings and thrashes his guitar. She looks up at him with the same undivided attention as she keeps steady, thundering time. And it's kind of hot as shit.
There's a chemistry, right? And in the early years, he's yelling at her during the performances when you read about this. Then you see something like described in Rolling Stone on that Kilbourne performance. So if you want to see this from the early days, that's a great spot to hit in the show notes. The interplay between the two of them is always very intense. And honestly, I think is what sells them, to your point, right? If you could see other people do a drums guitar duo, there's something about, there is a sexuality to it, but there's definitely a sensuality to it, right? And Jack says something else in that 2005 Rolling Stone piece that is going to become essential to the story that we are telling today. Read that quote.
It will always be us two. I will never do the White Stripes with another drummer, and she'll never do it with another guitarist.
Okay, so let's focus on Meg for a minute. We've talked a lot about Jack. This letter we got does not ask about Jack. It asks about Meg. So let's jump in there.
Yeah, and to be honest, there isn't a lot about Meg to focus on, right? Which is kind of perfect for our podcast and why Fernando sent us this letter. Here's a few things. One, Meg is from the same suburb as Greg Alexander from the New Radicals, if you were just listening to our last most recent episode. And, as mentioned on that episode, John 5.
Opposite to Jack in a lot of ways, Meg is, okay? She's the second of two kids instead of the last of 10. And she is always quiet and reserved. Anything you read about her, anytime anyone talks about her, they talk about how quiet she is, not how they describe Jack.
And the beginning of the relationship with Jack and the end of the relationship with Jack, the romantic end anyway, has never been explained or flashed out in the media. They were very private about it and always tight-lipped, which fits right with the story, the mystique of the band, who they are, why are they look like pieces of candy, and are they really brother and sister?
She didn't go to college. She thought she might pursue a culinary career. She starts hanging out with Jack in the early 90s, marries him by 96, and the next year is when she'll sit on the drums in the attic practice space and something special will happen.
Yeah. One thing I don't want to bring up, but you got to bring up because people do. It's important to the story is that throughout her career, people will kind of question, point at the fact of her ability and skills about her drumming.
Including Jack, to a certain extent. Lots of coded language in the way he talks about her in interviews, about her being childlike or simple or whatever. And that episode of About a Girl that we mentioned earlier really dives into this. But there is this great quote in David Frick's piece on the band for Rolling Stone, which I think happens in 05, where he asks, are there times when Meg's style of drumming is too limiting and that you can't take a song as far as you'd like it to go? And Jack's response is, no, I never thought, God, I wish Neil Peart was in this band. But he goes on to say, it's kind of funny when people critique hip hop, they're scared to open up for fear of being called racist, but they're not scared to open up on female musicians out of pure sexism. That's from Jack White.
Totally. And from the only time I saw them live and going down YouTube like wormholes of freakiness watching their live performances, what I love about it and the interplay between the two of them and when they're looking at each other and there's different parts of songs and they're segging from like a verse into the middle eighth or the verse to the chorus is that when they're looking at each other, the tempo changes. It's definitely 100% imperfect. On purpose, instead of where it's like you're supposed to be playing to a metronome.
Yeah,
she's not. And that
seems
not
very different. Seems very different than watching a pop band, right? Like when you watch them, it seems like they are creating something live and in front of you, as opposed to reciting something that they know all the parts to.
Yeah, Melissa Gianni wrote a piece for Elle magazine last year in which she tries to get an interview with Meg. I remember this. She uses a White Stripes gets a Rock and Roll Hall of Fame nomination as an excuse. Spoiler alert, nope, doesn't succeed. But the article they end up publishing does spend a lot of time talking about this exact issue.
Yeah, and I like, there's a specific quote in that piece from a fan of the band who becomes a musician, basically hears them as a kid, becomes a musician, is now in a band I believe called Plum, and has spent time with Meg through some weird happenstance, has actually met her. And she says, quote, I can't speculate at all, and I feel weird even saying it. But maybe if she hadn't had such harsh feedback all the time, the White Stripes wouldn't have ended.
Yeah, so this leads us to what does happen with this band and with Meg?
Yeah, okay, so let's go back to the beginning and then come back to the end.
Yeah, so they play local shows in Detroit beginning in 97. And at some point, the Detroit Cobras tell Jack to call a guy named Long Gone John, who is running a record label called Sympathy for the Record Industry on the West Coast. Brian, can I talk about this record label?
Yeah, talk about Sympathy.
So for freak's sake, dude, when I was in college and we were eventually running this college radio station with my friend Lisa – at some point, we got this extra status with a trade magazine called Gavin. And once we did that, we could not keep track of the amount of CDs that
right,
we received.
Right, right. It makes you more valuable to the labels.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds. But what was cool was when we got on the mailing list for Sympathy for the Music Industry, because I knew that, like, holy crap, how does this little bitty label with the best bands, why are they sending us records? Because they had the Head Coats, Billy Childish, they had the Lazy Cougars, they had the fucking Dwarves, the Mummies, Man or Astro Man, the Oblivions, Rocket from the Crypt, the 5678s, yeah. The Muffs, and the White Stripes.
That label will release the first three records. Great, great quote from Long Gone John from a 2002 piece about the band where he says, I didn't think there was much of a chance I'd ever get to do the third record. A much larger independent than myself made a substantial offer, and when it seemed that the White Stripes were steering away from major labels still, I agreed to meet that offer, and that was it. I got to do that record. But it doesn't last.
Yeah, by record number four, they do take a deal with V2XL, which is basically Virgin, Richard Branson's freak show, and they release Elephant, and Seven Nation Army explodes.
And so it's the next album cycle in 2005 when Jack does that interview that we mentioned earlier with David Frick for Rolling Stone. And I bring it back up here because Frick goes hard in this encounter. He kind of a dick in this interview, in my opinion. He starts asking questions specifically about Meg. Read some of this interplay between Jack and David Frick.
By the way, David Frick is on the nomination committee for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. So here's David Frick. How has Meg managed to stay out of the spotlight that is on you all the time? Jack, Meg always says the more you talk, the less people listen. She's right. She doesn't open her mouth very much. She doesn't care about the photos or any of that stuff. David Frick, what does she care about? Jack White, she's a very simple person. She loves music. Her record collection is twice as big as mine. David Frick, can you imagine being in a band without her? Jack, not this band. All the beauty would be gone.
There's a story that I ran across that when the divorce papers become official in 2000, I'm curious if you heard this, that the band had a local show in Detroit coming up, and Jack had basically assumed that because the marriage was over, the band was over. Again, this is a thing that they don't talk about much. This is about the only thing anecdote I could find about it. And supposedly he had recruited a different band to fill dates. It was going to be two other dudes and him, and they were just going to be a replacement band for the White Stripes. But the story is that Meg showed up at this small bar that they were going to play at, but it was a pretty big show for them, and said, okay, let's do it. Let's do it one more time. And that time was so good, they decided they needed to keep going.
And what an amazing story to get a divorce and then to continue having
I can't. Let's talk about that for a second. Can you imagine?
Yeah. No. I couldn't.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, no. It's wild to me.
No, for me, like, romantic relationship is all or nothing.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So I couldn't imagine...
Especially something so sexually charged. Like, I understand that, you know what I'm saying? Like, what you describe, right? Like, there is a chemistry to that. And if you've got somebody, I mean, I like to think I'm pretty secure in my own thing and in my relationship and all that sort of stuff. But if my wife was on stage every night with a good-looking dude singing love songs, it'd be hard. That'd be a hard thing to kind of process, right? And I would think, so it's a strange thing. I mean, we'll talk about this a little bit, but they both will get married again. They'll be around in each other's weddings and stuff. It's, you know, they develop a great friendship. I mean, there is a version of this, I think, where you say, listen, they were kids. I mean, they were very young when they got together, 21, 2021, right? And so at a certain point, you grow up and it's a little different, all that sort of stuff. But still, creating this whole career with this person and this whole thing where you guys are, you know, dependent on each other, you are in a monogamous relationship, you know what I mean? Even if it's not sexual. So it's an interesting thing. Yeah, they do eventually stop, though. To your point, this thing has to end for our story, at least. And that finally happens in 2007. They release an album called Icky Thump. They tour Canada. They come back and do the southern part of the U.S., and they're scheduled to do a fall tour.
By the way, Icky Thump was leaked, and radio stations around the country were playing the leak. Like, that's how hot that band had gotten.
Band was so big.
And the live record that they did at the time, which it's feel like live records or whatever, like my squeeze like thinks live records are the worst thing ever. But like the accompanying video is really cool. That's it's recorded in Canada. It's all grainy and perfect. Like, it doesn't look great. I was reading from the Elle magazine piece from last year. Now this is and then July 31st, 2007. So we're getting here at the end of the story of the band. Following a celebratory toast before the last show of a series of Southern U.S. tour dates, Meg confides to Ben Blackwell, Jack's nephew and the band's official archivist, that he's about to see the final White Stripes show. I was like, oh, you mean of this leg? Blackwell recalls now. And she said, no, I think this is the last one, and just walked away.
And with the exception of appearing on Conan O'Brien's last late night episode in 09, this is basically it.
Yeah. In 2007, they released a statement saying they won't do the fall tour because of Meg's acute anxiety. And they wait until 2011 to officially say that they are breaking up.
And at that point, they state that the end of the band was, quote, not due to artistic differences or lack of wanting to continue, nor any health issues, as both Meg and Jack are feeling fine and in good health. It is for a myriad of reasons, but mostly to preserve what is beautiful and special about the band and have it stay that way.
Yeah, and she basically hasn't been seen in public in a meaningful way in 15 years.
So all the speculation about her and about what happened to her started again in earnest last year because, as you already mentioned, they get this nomination for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And so this writer from Elle does find a friend who knows Meg and can speak on her behalf. And basically the story is that she lives in Detroit and she's fine.
We do know that she married again, Patty and Fred Sonic Smith's son, Jackson.
Now, that to me is a funny little cherry on the top detail that she will briefly be married to the son of the guy from the MC5. Right. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it almost feels obligatory. Like, well, you're like, well, if I'm really going to be part of Detroit music history, let me just go ahead and kick out these jams. A double wedding, too, in Jack's backyard. And so it was her and Fred, Sonic Smith's son, and then one of the guys from the Raconteurs gets married. They're all in Jack's property. So, I mean, again, it's like, it's wild to think of your relationship swinging that way.
But that's all over by 2013, I think, and that's mostly it.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting to talk a little bit about how different this would have been received now. So 2007 to now, I mean, I don't have to do the math because I have a 17-year-old daughter. So 17 years ago, the talk about mental health, especially when it came to celebrities, people in the spotlight, I don't think this conversation resonated in the way it does now. I think now, if you had a famous duo say, listen, we've got to step away from this because of anxiety issues, depression, etc., you'd have an outpouring of support. People would be like, how brave, etc., right? I don't know that it was really felt that way in 2007. Like, how do you recollect this?
Well, I think that was a bit of news for people because I think they thought like that was it, like it was Meg's anxiety, like, because I remember it happening, like that was what broke up the band, and they were hot, like they were at the top of their game, like they weren't, you know, running around playing arenas and not sounding great,
right? Well, as we've pointed out, they're very calculated. So there's also a certain version of this where you say, if they realize that they're not happy, the way to go out is to just go out, as opposed to letting it wane, as opposed to reinventing it. And Jack, to his credit, sticks to this idea where he says, this is, I mean, multiple places that we read, right? Throughout the year, several different interviews where he will say, this is only a Jack and Meg thing. And he'll go on and do tons of other stuff, obviously. He does the Raconteurs. While they're a band, he will do his solo records. He does the Dead Weather. Like, Jack has plenty to do. But Meg steps away from it all. Couple of good notes to end on. There's a friend who was with them early on who gets quoted in one of these articles and says that he's at a Jack solo show in 2018 and realizes that Meg is side stage and loving every minute of it. Like, she's totally into it, which is something I really like hearing. Secondly, read that paragraph from the Elle magazine piece from last year where it kind of wraps it all up.
Sure. This is the writer talking. At long last, I get Meg White's friend on the line. She asks not to be named in the story, but assures me that Meg is fine, that she's human, and that she has good days and bad days. To further ease my mind, she adds that Meg eats a Honey Crisp apple every day to keep the doctor.
That's that rock and roll money, man. You know how much Honey Crisp apples cost?
They're expensive, especially organic.
Yeah, I know, right?
She spent 15 years traveling and touring and playing. It's not that odd to think that she likes to be at home, she tells me.
I mean, fair enough. Here's my question, though. In this age, 2024, where we have basically seen every band in the world reunite. I mentioned this, I think, last week or on a recent show where I said my brother and I have this joke where we text each other whenever some band announces that come out of nowhere that they're getting back together or that they break up and then get back together a year later. Nobody ever breaks up, right? This band disbanded. Half of it disappears out of the public consciousness. Do you think she'll stay gone? Do you think there is an amount of money or an amount of energy or a change in her psyche that would bring her back into the limelight?
You know, my gut says no. And I don't know about you, but like Jack really changed his image. Like when he went solo as this troubadour and here's my record label and I'm moving to Nashville, and everything that he did post White Stripes has definitely shown him as being like, I mean, he's a well-known pop culture figure now that is outside of the, you know, what would be sort of the indie rock type of thing. And this last record he put out is the only record I've really loved of his because it sounded like the White Stripes.
Dude, it's so funny. So funny that you'd say that, because my friend who's a hardcore Jack White guy has been falling off the wagon for the last several records. And when this one came out, he was like, dude, he's back. Like, I think there is a feeling that this the energy is back in that respect.
It feels over-modulated and loud.
It's loud AF. Like, it is just in your face again.
But I kind of feel that this is a band we won't see again until the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, which to me is weird that that's even a consideration. I'm just saying, Iron Maiden's not in the Rock and Roll
Hall
of Fame.
I know, I kept doing the math, being like, wait, they are eligible? But yeah, I mean, because of when they broke up, they I guess it's 15 years, right?
Dionne Warwick beat their ass in, so walk on by.
I mean, I there is a little bit of like stubborn cred that I would give them, and I kind of, I mean, it's not that I don't, I want them to do what's good for them, right? And I want people who love them, and if it makes them happy to see them get back together or whatever, fine. I'm not going to begrudge that, right? But I do think there is something pretty badass about walking away from it and never coming back. If they can really do it.
But hey, as far as that scene goes, which, I mean, this really predates them by decades, but it was great that the MC5 got in before them. So that's, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, that is pretty cool. Hey, if you have got a question you want us to dig into and do some research, we love it. That's why we're here. You get it. You've heard it. That's the show. So please, by all means, wearethestoryguys@gmail.com. If you have something you want to send us, check us out on patreon.com/rockandrollbedtimestories. It's an easy way to support the show, get extra content, get an easy touch with us. And also, you can find us on Instagram.com/rockandrollbedtimestories or on YouTube, where you can see some of the episodes with live video feeds and other content that we have up there. So, wow. Until next time, Murdoch, what should people keep doing?
Keep telling stories.
Rock and Roll Bedtime Stories is a Story Guys production. The show is produced and edited by Brian Eichenberger. Get more stories, hear more podcasts, and book the guys for your conference or house party at wearethestoryguys.com. Copyright Boy Have We Got Stories Productions. All rights reserved.